Stop. This message could save you from investing your precious time into a true crime story that goes nowhere. Avoid that disappointment. You need True Crime Feed Podcast. Unlimited, premium, true crime, curated for you. Find out about a female serial dater turned serial killer. The truth about the DARE program. Bizarre black markets, political murder plots, and a school for troubled teens so horrific it could be a Stephen King novel. You know those feels you get when you're turning into a primo true crime podcast? The thrill chills. You can't get enough. But not every podcast hits the same. You can spend hours sifting through mediocre shows that don't deliver the goods. Well, not anymore. True Crime Feed Podcast has your back. True Crime Feed sifts through the archives from the past decade to select the best cases and gives you a quick overview sprinkled with a teensy bit of humor, plus a weekly top three power ranking for shows currently trending, and lets you know what shows to send down your podcast queue trapdoor. You know you want those thrill chills. So, come and get them. Subscribe to True Crime Feed. That's True Crime, F-E-E-D, wherever you get your podcasts. Mother's Day is almost here. Have you found that truly special sentimental gift for your mom yet? Don't worry, I got you. MyLifeInABook.com is a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges that she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and your children can treasure forever. Your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. I loved this idea so much that I've started my own My Life in a Book for my children to have. The thought of my son and daughter being able to learn about my life story as they grow into their own adulthood is truly special. It's been an enjoyable journey of self-reflection for me too, with questions like, which one event made the greatest impact on your life? It's brought back memories I didn't even know I had. I love it, and I know your mother will too. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code SERIALNAPPER at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code SERIALNAPPER for 10% off today. Hey everyone, my name is Nikki Young, and this is Serial Napper, the number one true crime podcast for naps. I'm back with another true crime story to lull you to sleep, or perhaps to give you nightmares. If you're listening to the podcast for the very first time, or you haven't had a chance to listen to the episode just before this one, the Timothy Evans case, stop here and go back and listen to that one first. These two stories are very much connected, and I highly recommend starting with Timothy's case before you hear John's. John Christie was a World War I and II veteran who lived with his wife, Ethel, in the bottom floor flat of 10 Rillington Place, a low-income apartment building in London's Notting Hill district. In the 50s, there was a media storm when one of the tenants living in the same building as John, a man named Timothy Evans, was convicted of murdering his pregnant wife and baby daughter, despite claiming innocence. John and his wife were star witnesses in that trial, testifying that their upstairs neighbor, Timothy, and his wife argued constantly, and the night before her murder, they had heard a loud thud in the night. Timothy was hanged for his crime, and life went back to normal for John and Ethel Christie. That is, until another tenant of 10 Rillington Place made a horrifying discovery. The bodies of six women hidden in the walls, floors, and garden of the apartment building. One of the bodies found was Ethel Christie, John's wife, leading the police to believe that John Christie had murdered her along with the other women hidden in his flat. This war veteran was a serial killer, and what he did to his victims is particularly disturbing. With this shocking revelation, many wondered if John Christie had also killed Timothy Evans' wife and baby just a few years prior, meaning they had hanged an innocent man, a grieving husband and father. John Christie would be dubbed the sex strangler of Notting Hill, but had he also framed Timothy for murder? Let's jump right in. Before he was a prolific serial killer with dark, menacing eyes, John Reginald Christie was born on April 8, 1899, in Yorkshire, England, to a large middle-class family of seven children. Known to his close friends and family as Reg, he had a difficult and confusing upbringing. His mother, who he described as a wonderful woman, coddled him. It was well known that John was her favorite child, and she sheltered him away from the world from a very young age. His father, on the other hand, was strict, making the children march in line like little soldiers. He was also physically abusive and subjected him and his siblings to beatings. This left John feeling really confused, with one parent smothering him with love and affection, while the other was angry and physically abused him. As such, John was said to be a high-strung hypochondriac who knew how to fake being ill or injured in order to get attention. If he was feeling particularly lonely, he'd pretend to be really sick or to hurt himself so that his mother and his sisters would dote on him. It's said that John also hated dirt and the feeling of being unclean, despite his obsession with gardening. Gardening seemed to be his only solace, an activity that he had learned from his father. While John was described as incredibly smart for his age with a high IQ, he was equally as socially awkward. He had low confidence and basically no friends, though not for lack of trying. At school, he'd join in on sports. At church, he sang in the choir. He went through the motions, doing the things that he believed he was supposed to be doing, but internally, he was struggling to figure out just who he was. There was one incident in particular that happened when he was 8 years old that caused him a lot of internal turmoil. His grandfather died, and he had the opportunity to see him lying in the casket during the wake. In the past, his grandfather was a person who scared him, intimidated him, but now he was just a lifeless corpse. John would say that this single experience was life-changing for him, as it sparked a lifelong fascination with the dead. He began spending much of his free time hanging out in graveyards, even attempting to look inside the cracks of coffins, hoping to get a peek of the body inside. Looking at corpses was really one of the only things that exhilarated him. Sexually, he was stunted. He was late to the game, as his low self-esteem kept him from dating, and his parents never explained the birds and the bees. Most of what he learned came in the form of listening to other schoolmates brag about their encounters. During those rare occasions when he did find himself with a girl, he couldn't get aroused. He was impotent, earning himself nicknames from the other boys like No Dick Reggie and Can't Do It Christie, and this made him hate women. The issue wasn't that he couldn't get it up at all. He just couldn't with a willing, conscious participant. So he began to spy on women who had no idea that they were being watched. He visited sex workers who would play into his fantasies. And later in life, he admitted, quote, "The only way he could attain potency was with victims he rendered helpless." At 15 years old, John quit school and started working in a local movie theater as a projectionist. When World War I broke out, he enlisted with the British Army as a signalman, even though he was just 17 years old at the time. He joined the 52nd Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire Regiment. Despite the grueling conditions, he seemed to thrive in the military, starting the war as a private and then getting promoted 3 times during his service. Towards the end of the war, he was injured during a mustard gas attack, and he was sent to the infirmary. John would claim his injuries were so extensive that he was now blind, and for 3 years, he hid away from the world, claiming that he couldn't speak. That is, if you believe his word, because John was known to embellish for attention. In actuality, doctors believed his symptoms to be hysteria. There weren't any reports to confirm these injuries, and he was discharged from the army as fit for duty. After leaving the military, he worked as a clerk for some time, and then he met and married his wife, Ethel, in May of 1920. Ethel's friends would say that she was fearful of her new husband and basically just went along with whatever he wanted. And truly, looking at photos of John Christie, I can kind of understand why. I don't know what it is, but there's something about the eyes of men like John Christie. They're the same kind of dead, soulless eyes that we see on many other serial killers. They look evil, unhinged, soulless, and unstoppable. John would pretend theirs was a happy marriage, but he continued to visit sex workers the entire time, unable to perform in bed with his wife. Again, this made him angry and hateful. He started to become more violent at home, causing the couple to separate after only 4 years of marriage. Ethel remained in their marital home located in Sheffield, while John moved to London, where he began a life of petty crime. He started with small crimes like theft when he stole a bike from a 12-year-old child. But as time passed, his crimes grew more serious. On one occasion, he moved into an apartment with a young mother and her son. This living arrangement didn't last long. During an argument about John's refusal to get a job, John took a cricket bat to the back of her head, seriously injuring her. For this, he was given a 6-month prison sentence. But over the next decade, John would spend his time in and out of jail for crimes like larceny and assault. He must have had some kind of epiphany during his last stint in prison because he decided to reach back out to his wife Ethel to try to reconcile and save their marriage. Ethel was still living in their home back in Sheffield, but she had been having a 4-year affair with a man that she worked with. This man had no idea that Ethel was married. She told him that her husband died in the war during a mustard gas attack. She loved this man she was having an affair with, much more than she had ever loved her husband, John. But when he found out that she couldn't bear children, he broke things off with her, leaving her in a predicament. So when John tried to make his way back into her life, she allowed it. John was released from prison, and he and Ethel decided to have a fresh start, moving into a new ground floor flat at 10 Rillington Place in Notting Hill. As I mentioned in Timothy's episode, Notting Hill today, the version that you see in movies, is absolutely lovely, but it's not at all how it was back then. Back then, it was an area that had been brutalized by bomb raids during the war, and it was now home to many low-income families stacked one on top of the other. It was while living here that World War II broke out, and John Christie decided to do his part by joining the War Reserve Police, despite the fact that he had a criminal history, which I guess they just ignored. The War Reserve Police were responsible for things like finding draft deserters and punishing them, helping those injured during bomb raids, and enforcing wartime curfews. In his role, he didn't deploy overseas. He stayed on the home front. During the day, he played his role as law enforcement, and then during the night, while Ethel was away visiting family members, he would bring in various sex workers back to his apartment to help carry out his fantasies. He wanted someone who would basically play dead, who was rendered helpless or at least pretended to be. It was also during this time that he met a woman at the police station who he seemingly fell in love with and began a 4-year-long relationship with. Her husband was deployed to the war front, allowing John to have complete access to this girl whenever he wanted. John's wife, Ethel, certainly wasn't going to stand in the way. She was the kind of woman who stood by her man just out of principle alone, out of duty, though she was probably thankful that her angry, violent husband was spending most of his time outside of the home. When this woman's husband came home from the war and discovered his wife was now sleeping with John Christie, he beat the crap out of John. And this seems to be when something inside of John truly broke. It's believed that John Christie kills his first known victim in 1944. My family is getting ready to make a big move across the ocean to a place where English isn't the spoken language. This isn't my first rodeo, so I'm making sure I'm fully prepared by learning the language ahead of time. Sure, I know I can use an app once I get there, but you'd be shocked by how much gets lost in translation. I want to talk like a local, which is why I'm excited to use Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone truly immerses you in the language you want to learn and has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Italian, German, and more. Rosetta Stone helps you to think in the language you're learning using an intuitive process that's designed for long-term retention. Their built-in True Accent feature gives you feedback on your pronunciation so that you're easily understood by native speakers. They have convenient desktop and app options, so you can learn on the go, and they offer a lifetime membership that includes all 25 languages at an incredible value. And now you can save even more with 50% off. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Serial Napper listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Sunnier, warmer days are almost here. Why not get a head start on looking and feeling your best this summer by trying something new like Factor's no prep, no mess meals that are ready to eat in just 2 minutes? Get a helping hand to meet your wellness goals with Factor's chef-crafted meals that include different nutritional options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Healthy meal planning has never looked so good with Factor's fresh, never frozen meals that are also dietitian approved. No matter how busy you are, Factor can help kickstart and maintain a new healthy routine by making it easy to enjoy nutritious meals on the go. Plus, you'll never get bored eating the same thing every day because they offer 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week. We're talking restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon because eating healthy doesn't have to be boring. Personally, I love not having to overthink what I'm going to eat every single day because that's half the battle, and I don't have to bother with shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. But the best part is, these meals are delicious with ingredients you can trust. Crush your wellness goals this May. Head to factormeals.com/napper50 and use code NAPPER50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code NAPPER50 at factormeals.com/napper50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Ruth First was a young Australian munitions worker. The job didn't pay much, so it's alleged that she had supplemented her income by doing sex work part-time on the side. John Christie met Ruth in a bar one day, and he was taken by her, just fascinated by her. She was a beautiful 21-year-old girl, tall with brown hair and big brown eyes. John's wife, Ethel, would often leave town to visit family, and this is when John would invite Ruth over to 10 Rillington Place to exchange sex for money. During one of these encounters, John received a telegram that said that Ethel was on her way home early with her brother. According to John, Ruth undressed and basically told him to hurry up and get it over with. While they were doing the deed, John decided to strangle her to death. Then he hid her body, along with all of her clothes and her belongings, under the floorboards of his flat. Ethel arrived home with her brother shortly after, none the wiser of what had just happened in her apartment. When Ruth's body began to decompose and smell, John moved her to the overgrown garden located at the back of his apartment building. The following day, he dug up Ruth's clothing and he decided to burn it to get rid of the evidence. Over time, some of her bones would become unearthed, including her skull, so he pulled it up and decided to burn it too. He found this experience exhilarating, and after killing Ruth, he also found he wasn't able to become aroused by a woman unless she was helpless. Shortly after Ruth's murder, John decided to quit his job as a police officer and become a clerk at a radio factory. He meets a colleague by the name of Muriel Amelia Eady. One day, Muriel comes into work sick, suffering from a bad case of bronchitis. John says he has a cure for her, a homemade remedy that he can make her if she comes with him back to his apartment flat. She does, and as it turns out, this homemade remedy is actually a mixture of household gas containing carbon monoxide. Muriel is knocked unconscious, and John begins to sexually assault her while he strangles her to death. He buries her body right next to Ruth in the overgrown garden located in the backyard. Supposedly, all the while, John's wife Ethel is completely unaware of her husband's secret. And that brings us to 1948, when the Evans family moved into the top floor flat of 10 Rillington Place. They were a young couple, Timothy and his wife Beryl, and they had a little baby girl named Geraldine shortly after they moved into the building. Before their first child had her first birthday, Beryl discovered that she was pregnant again. This put a lot of strain on the couple, who started arguing over whether or not they could afford to keep this child. John Christie overheard one of these arguments, and allegedly he offered them a solution. Now again, if you haven't listened to Timothy Evans' story on my podcast, make sure you pause here, go back, and listen to that one first. John tells Timothy and Beryl that he has the knowledge and training to help terminate her pregnancy. Secretly, of course, because at that time, abortions were illegal. He says that he was medically trained in the war, and he shows off a medical textbook that he has in his apartment as proof. Timothy absolutely doesn't want to, but Beryl is determined to end her pregnancy. In the end, it's agreed that the following day, while Timothy is at work, John Christie will perform the abortion on Beryl. Instead, the next day, John goes up to Beryl's apartment and gives her his special gas, quote unquote, which is actually carbon monoxide. Once Beryl is passed out, he doesn't perform any kind of surgery on her. Instead, he strangles her to death while he sexually assaults her, just as he had done with the previous two victims. Later that day, when Timothy arrives home from work, John tells him that the abortion has failed and his wife has died. He tells them, "Don't worry, I'll take care of the body so that no one gets in any kind of trouble," because again, abortions were illegal at the time. John instructs Timothy to sell off all of his belongings and get out of town. He'll give baby Geraldine to a family who will look after her. Timothy is a very simple man, and he buys whatever story John is giving him. So Timothy sells everything he owns, and he leaves town, never seeing his wife or his baby girl again. Only a few weeks later, Timothy walks into a police station full of guilt and regret and tells them that he has disposed of his wife after she died from a failed abortion. He doesn't mention John Christie's name at this time, instead saying that a man at a cafe had given him pills to induce a miscarriage, resulting in his wife's death after she had taken them. Timothy tells them that He dumped his wife's body down a sewer drain. But when the police go to look for Beryl's body down the drain, they can't find it. In fact, they determined it would have been impossible for Timothy to remove the manhole cover of the sewer by himself because it was far too heavy. It had actually taken them 3 men to move this manhole cover. This is when Timothy tells the police all about John Christie and that botched abortion. The police perform another search, this time an extensive search of 10 Rillington Place. The building didn't have electricity or indoor plumbing. Instead, it had a wash house in the backyard right alongside that overgrown garden. When investigators search the wash house, they find the bodies of both Beryl and baby Geraldine wrapped in a green cloth. Beryl's body showed signs that she had been sexually assaulted. At the time, police had no idea that just a few feet away lay the bodies of 2 of John Christie's other victims buried in the garden. John had made it so glaringly obvious, even using one of the victim's femur bones to prop up a trellis. But thanks to shoddy police work, they didn't even notice. Back at the station, the authorities weren't buying Timothy's accusations of John's botched abortion. They believed that Timothy Evans no longer wanted his family because it was just such a huge financial strain, so he decided to kill his wife and his baby. When the police speak to John Christie, he tells them that the last time he saw Beryl Evans was on November 8th, around noon, as she left to run errands with her little baby girl. He claimed to have overheard a loud argument between Timothy and Beryl Evans about this unwanted pregnancy and the plan to take the abortion pills, but he intervened. He tried warning the couple that these pills were dangerous and she shouldn't take them. According to John, Beryl looked absolutely terrified of her husband at that time. Later that evening, John and Ethel said they were trying to sleep when suddenly they heard a loud thump noise come from Timothy's apartment upstairs. Then they heard what they believed was someone dragging something heavy across the floor. When it went quiet again, they fell back to sleep, but they had not seen Beryl or the baby since then. John alleged that the next day, Timothy told them a story of how Beryl had left to see family in Bristol. Timothy would sell off all of his belongings and move out of 10 Rillington Place just a short while later, allegedly telling John that he was joining his wife. The police believed John Christie's story, despite Timothy's claims that John was the real killer. John and Ethel would become the star witnesses during Timothy's murder trial. Now, can you imagine the frustration of having this man, who you know killed your wife, testify on the stand that it was actually you who did it? Thanks in part to John Christie's testimony, Timothy was convicted of murder and sentenced to hang in 1950. John and Ethel returned to live in the ground floor unit of 10 Rillington Place. However, Ethel's health began to deteriorate. She was really anxious and depressed about the horrible murder that she believed her upstairs neighbor, Timothy, had committed, according to John at least. She stopped leaving the house, not even bothering to visit with her family in Sheffield as she had done often. This made it difficult for John to continue to bring sex workers back to his home, so he decided he had to get rid of Ethel. In December 1952, he murdered his wife in their bed by strangling her with a stocking before placing her body under the floorboards in their apartment. He wrote to her family members, telling them that Ethel was too sick to write herself, and she was trying to feel better by taking some vacations away out of town. With his wife now out of the way, John was free to continue his murder spree. He had his routine down pat, and within the span of just 3 months, he killed his last 3 victims, Rita Nelson, Kathleen Maloney, and Hectorina McLennan. Rita Nelson had been pregnant and wanting to terminate her pregnancy, so just like he had done with Beryl, John offered to perform a secret abortion to help her out. But instead, he gassed her, he strangled her, and he sexually assaulted her as she died. Kathleen Maloney was a sex worker, making her a victim of opportunity. Hectorina McLennan had chatted with John about subletting his apartment with her boyfriend, but she found herself as his final victim. Just as he had done with the others, he gassed them with carbon monoxide, strangled them to death while he sexually assaulted them. Then he hid the bodies in the kitchen pantry, which he papered over. John Christie then found a couple to pay him a few bucks to illegally sublet his apartment, and then he took off out of town. His landlord found the new tenants in John's apartment, and he kicked them out because he had no idea who they were or where John was or why they were in his apartment. No one knew where John Christie had taken off to, but just a short while later, the reason why he had left would be revealed. The landlord of the building allowed the tenants who lived above John's apartment to use his kitchen. And while they were in the kitchen, they decided to install a shelf. But they found a small alcove in the pantry that had been sealed up with paper and tape. They thought this was odd, so they began to peel back the paper, revealing that three bodies had been hidden away. They were the bodies of John's three latest victims. One of the women, described as a brunette around the age of 20, appeared to have been dead for around 4 weeks. She had been gassed with carbon monoxide before being strangled with a smooth surface kind of cord. Then she was sexually assaulted while she died. There were also large scratch marks on her back, indicating that after she was killed, she was dragged across the floor towards the kitchen pantry. Another victim, a young woman around age 25 with light brown hair, appeared to have been dead between 8 to 12 weeks. She again showed signs of being gassed and then strangled. She had also been heavily intoxicated at the time of her death, and she was sexually assaulted. This young lady was wearing a cardigan and a vest with another white garment that had been placed between her legs, sort of like a diaper. The third victim was a blonde woman around the age of 25. She had been dead for 8 to 12 weeks by the time she was found, and she was around 6 months pregnant at the time she was killed. When she was discovered, she was wearing a dress, petticoat, bra, cardigan, two vests, and then again, she had a garment placed between her legs like a diaper. John Christie had his killings down to a science, an absolute ritual. When investigators noticed some of the floorboards were loose in the front room, they decided to take a closer look. And as they pulled up the boards, they found yet another body, John's wife, Ethel Christie. She was rolled up in a flannel blanket with a pillowcase over her head. It appeared that John had killed her at some point during the night when they were sleeping, as she was still dressed in her silk nightgown. She had been strangled, but unlike the others, she hadn't been poisoned with carbon monoxide and she had not been sexually assaulted. As they carefully tore apart every corner of 10 Rillington Place looking for more bodies, they noticed a femur sticking out of the garden in the backyard. When they dug it up, they found two more female bodies scattered below flower beds and bushes. Both bodies had been there for a minimum of 3 years, but they may have been there as many as 10. They would also find teeth, hair, and fabric in the garden, and they would need to try to reconstruct the bodies to confirm their ID. Later, they would be identified as 21-year-old Ruth Margaret and 32-year-old Muriel Amelia Eady. Now they had to track down the killer, and the police knew exactly who they were looking for. John Christie. The authorities were very familiar with John, as he had been a key witness in Timothy's murder trial just 3 years prior. John Christie was now completely broke, having already drained his dead wife's bank account, and now he was on the run from the police. He was also homeless and spending most of his nights sleeping on park benches. When he saw his photo on the cover of every newspaper in the area, he tried to change up his appearance just a bit by wearing hats over his balding head. Unfortunately for John, having been a big part of Timothy Evans' trial, he was very recognizable, especially to the police. And one day, shortly after the bodies had been found, he was spotted by a police officer. Initially, he tried giving them a fake name when he stopped, but they know it's him, and he's arrested. On his person, he's carrying an ID card, which confirms his name, John Christie. He's got a ration book and an old newspaper clipping about Timothy Evans' case. How bizarre. John Christie would only be charged with the murder of his wife, Ethel Christie. And again, I have no idea why, but this was the way that British law was set up back then. He claimed that he had woken up in the middle of the night to find his wife blue in the face lying beside him. He looked at their side table to see an open pill bottle that was now nearly empty, and he realized that Ethel had tried to take her own life. John said he couldn't stand to see her suffering, so he grabbed one of her stockings and he strangled her to death. He left her body laying in their bed for a few days trying to figure out what to do, and then he came up with this brilliant idea to place her under the floorboards in the front room. John would admit to killing all seven women, including Beryl Evans, who was initially believed to have been killed by her husband. In all cases, he downplayed his actions and he mostly blamed the women for their own deaths. With Kathleen Maloney, he claimed that she was blackmailing him, saying that if he didn't pay her 30 shillings, she would accuse him of assaulting her. John said she had even followed him back to his house, screaming profanities at him, and then grabbing a frying pan in an attempt to hit him, so he had to act. He had to defend himself. He said he blacked out, and when he had woken up, he had apparently strangled her to death. He went back to bed and thought about it for a bit, then he decided to wrap her up and put her in the kitchen alcove the following day. His excuses for the other victims were just as ridiculous, and they often involved them falling into ropes that just so happened to strangle them to death. He didn't really take any accountability. He admitted to being involved in their death, but he always made it seem like it was their fault. He was just doing the right thing, being a good guy. With Beryl Evans, Timothy's wife, he claimed it was a mercy killing. She had tried to kill herself because she couldn't stand to be pregnant, but she couldn't go through with it. So John said he gassed her and then he strangled her to death. He didn't address the fact that Beryl had also been sexually assaulted. John, however, would never admit to killing baby Geraldine Evans. Because Geraldine was found wrapped up in the same cloth right beside her mother Beryl, most people believed that he probably did kill the baby too, because how likely is it that there were two killers living at 10 Rillington Place who hid bodies in the same place? John admitted his guilt, but he also pleaded insanity. The jury wasn't buying his story. He was found guilty and he was sentenced to hang. In fact, John Christie would be hanged by the very same executioner who had hanged Timothy Evans. Now, there are people who believe that there were two killers living at 10 Rillington Place at the same time. John Christie, who had killed his wife and then gassed and strangled and sexually assaulted several other women in a short period of time, and Timothy Evans, who was hanged for killing his pregnant wife and baby daughter. But there are also those who believe Timothy Evans was innocent, that he was just a simpleton, and he was the perfect setup guy for John Christie when the police were getting a little too close to finding out who he truly was and what he was hiding in the walls, the floorboards, and the garden. The dilapidated, broken brick buildings of Notting Hill have since been torn down, and they've been rebuilt into beautiful new homes. However, there is a gap left where 10 Rillington Place used to stand, and considering the history, it's probably for the best. Unfortunately, there appears to be more questions than answers in this story, and it's likely that it will never be completely resolved. Still, I'd love to hear what you think, so make sure you let me know in the comments. That's it for me tonight. If you want to reach out, you can find me on Facebook at Serial Napper. I also have a Serial Napper true crime discussion group on Facebook. It's called Serial Society, and I'll have the link in my show notes. I'd love to chat with you about this case and all of the other cases that I cover, plus whatever is going on in true crime. You can find my audio on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. I post all of my episodes in video format over on YouTube, so go check it out. And if you're watching on YouTube, I would love if you can give me a thumbs up and subscribe. I'm over on X, formerly known as Twitter, at @Serial_Napper, and I post things on TikTok, Serial Napper Nick, and that's all one word. Until next time, sweet dreams, stay kind, especially in the comments. Bye.
What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with two chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.